In the 8th Psalm, David asked a question. The 4th verse. What is man that thou art mindful of him? And the son of man that thou visitest him? What is man that thou art mindful of him? A creature of dust, the mighty God of the universe, mindful of man? David asked that question. God's interest focused on man in his design for creation. For in Genesis 1:26, he said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Man from dust, reflecting the image of the eternal God. And then he says, "What is the Son of Man that thou visitest him?" There were no sons of men until after sin. Why should God visit man, even though he made him the image of God? Image of himself, visit man after man failed him so miserably. Not only did he visit him, but we're told how he visited him in Romans the 8th chapter and the 3rd verse, Romans 8:3. For what the law could not do that it was weak to the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. He who created man in his own image after his likeness, when he visited the sons of men, he sent his Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. With this picture of God's design, of God's hope, and of God's sacrifice for man, we must add certain things from the book of Revelation. Let's notice the due force that's given the book in the very first verse, Revelation 1:1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him, to show unto his servants things which must die in the Greek. That which is absolutely necessary, they must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it unto by his angel unto his servant John. That which we shall see in the book of Revelation in regard to God's design for man, his mindfulness, his care for man, must come to pass. It is necessary, it is essential that it come to pass. And in this book, this last book of the Bible, a group of people is pictured. Turn to the 14th chapter and let us notice the first 5 verses. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Here it says that this group are redeemed from among men, not the dead. The word is not necros, the dead. They were redeemed from among men, the living. Not only that, it says that in their mouth was found no guile, falsehood, pseudos. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. If there is found in their mouth no guile, no falsehood, that means the heart was full of truth. Out of a heart in which truth had become its embodiment, they would speak. In fact, they reflect the image of Jesus fully, for He is the way, the truth, and the life. Now there are certain other things that are very obvious for the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation tells us the divine mediation ceases prior to the coming of Jesus as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Notice the 15th chapter and the 8th verse. And the temple was filled with the smoke of the glory of God and from His power, and no man, or no one, the text, was able to enter into the temple till the 7 plagues of the 7 angels were fulfilled. No one, no man was able to enter in. And we must keep in mind that there's one mediator between God and man, the man, Christ Jesus. Mediation has ceased. And it's not until later in the picture of Revelation that He comes King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And so I repeat again, divine mediation ceases prior to the coming of Jesus Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The conclusion is then warranted that a group of people prior to the redemption from among men have ceased to sin. 20th verse, for our conversation is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, the body of our fallen nature, that it may be fashioned like unto His glorious body, according to the working whereby He is able even to subdue all things unto Himself. The conclusion then is inevitable that here is a group of people, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. For you have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, that is Father. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God, and the children then heirs. Heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ. If so be that we suffer with Him, we shall also be glorified together. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. I think the word there for creature is creation in the original. For the earnest expectation of the creation waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. Paul has already declared, now are we the sons of God. As many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. Then it says the creation, the whole universe, as it were, is waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. Indicative of the fact, there's supposed to be a special manifestation of the sons of God ere the end. Andreessen, in commenting on this particular section, speaks of the language of this verse as saying that the whole creation is standing on tiptoes, scanning the horizon for the manifestation of its people of God that will reflect the image of Jesus fully. Let's continue to read. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly. Man was placed under a curse. The earth under a curse, not willingly, but by reason of Him who have subjected the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now, and not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of the body. For we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for. But if we hope for that which we see not, then we with patience wait for it. He has submitted the whole, He has subjected the whole of creation in hope. If you have it, why do you hope for it? The obvious is you don't have it, you're still hoping. And if we realize for what we're hoping, we in patience wait for it. We talk much about righteousness by faith. But let's remember what Paul also wrote in Galatians 5:5. For we, through the Spirit, wait for the hope of righteousness by faith. We wait for the hope of righteousness by faith. If you have it, why do you hope for it? The obvious thing, you don't have it yet. The whole creation is looking for it. The whole creation is wanting to see the realization of it. We, through the Spirit, hope for the righteousness which is by faith. Now, having looked at the scriptural basis for the answer to the question, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visit of him, let's look at some history. Adventism has been threaded with men and movements whose objective has been the realization of this objective, a life of sinlessness in a world of sin. Is that not our hope? A life of sinlessness in a world of sin? Is this not the hope that's held before us in the book of Revelation? And I say, there's threaded through the history of Adventism men and movements whose objectives have been the realization of how this can be accomplished. Let's look at a couple of them. The Holy Flesh Movement, from 1899 to 1901. Two names stand out in relationship to this movement, S.S. Davis and R.S. Donnell. One originated it, S.S. Davis, or was the instigator of it. He was in Evansville, Indiana, in evangelism, and he also noted beginning, and this was the beginning of the neo-Pentecostal movement of the present time. He saw there in the rise of Pentecostalism in Evansville power. And he said, we have the truth, they have the power. Put it together and we can move the world. And as a part of evangelistic team, he carried the message through many sections of Indiana. And the conference president was changed. R.S. Donnell came from the Upper Columbia, from out in the North Pacific, to Indiana. And he embraced it and took over its leadership. After the collapse of the movement, both of these men were sent identical sets of questions by the incoming conference president. Two questions were asked and answers given formed the basis of their teaching. Observe carefully the questions. This is question 8 and question 9. First question 8. Do you teach that conversion embraces the mind and the body, so that the body in this life is fully cleansed and is brought back to the condition of man before the fall, or is this a work that begins now and is completed at the resurrection of the just? Question 9. Do you teach that those who fully appropriate the offering of Christ by faith will never pass under the dominion of death, and that the reason men have died and do die is because they have failed to grasp the fullness of the gospel? To these questions, answers were given. They forthrightly answered all the questions that Elder Rankin sent to them. Notice carefully their answers, and they grouped them together on these two questions. Donnell, in his booklet that he published later on what I taught in Indiana, page 24 and 25, answers them thus. Men are accountable only for the light of the age in which they live. Interesting. With the resurrection, every imperfection will be left in the grave. Thus, they will be ready for the finishing touch of immortality when Jesus comes. And when you think this through, there's not too much wrong with this theology. Now, the next part. The 144,000 must also be ready for that finishing touch, and the perfection necessary for its reception must be attained in this life. Interesting. Now, Davis, in a letter to Hankins, I said Rankin back there, it's Hankins, dated March 15, 1903, said this, "So far as sin and holiness is concerned, it does in most cases begin here and end in the resurrection of the just, but not always. It was not so in Enoch and Elijah's cases. They never had a resurrection, and it will be said of those who will be living when probation ends, let him that is holy be holy still, and let him that is filthy be filthy still." They had a solution. Both of them used the same text, Hebrews 11:5. By faith Enoch was translated, contending Enoch, quoting from Second Testimony, page 122, was a representative of the saints who live amid the perils and corruptions of the last days. For his faithful obedience to God, he was translated. So also the faithful who are alive and remain will be translated. These men called to their defense the writings. And they emphasized the fact, for his faithful obedience to God, he was translated. So also the faithful who are alive and remain will be translated. It is at this point, in connection with their answers and the defense of their answers, that I had to make a judgment call when I did my research. Now that you might know the rest of the story behind the particular research, let me give you the data that I had to make a judgment call on, and I will tell you why I made the call as I made it. In doing this particular research, I was given, or I found, or was, whatever the situation was, I cannot recall that particular detail, from a document file, 190, in the Ellen G. White Estates, this report on a meeting in Indianapolis as the Holy Flesh movement was being broken up by a delegation from the General Conference that year. And in that delegation from the General Conference, I think it was headed by A.T. Jones, was Ellen G. White on her way back, or on her way to other appointments. Now, this individual who was present wrote this down, and this becomes a part of the document file. After the camp meeting, Sister White, Elder Eugene Farnsworth, and others came to Indianapolis Church. Sister White bore a decided testimony against this error. She stated that the workers who had been involved should not remain together, but that they should separate. And at the close of her discourse said, "When I am gone from here," and it's in direct quotes, "none are to pick up any points of this doctrine and call it truth. There is not a thread of truth in the whole fabric." This is a direct quote on the sole authority of an individual who was present. I took this particular quote and put it at the very front of the manuscript on the Holy Flesh movement. Now, I had some reasons for doing so. First, The Holy Flesh movement taught, unquestionably, that Christ took the nature of Adam before the fall. This particular doctrine at that time was the new theology that was entering the church. And I said to myself, what a powerful weapon I've got. There's not a thread of truth in the whole fabric, and so the doctrine that Christ took the nature of Adam before the fall is out. And I've got this statement. Because I was writing and doing that research in view of the incarnation. And secondly now, I must confess, and this reveals human weakness, this came from the church authority. And I was still a part of that authority. And so I chose this over another statement. Now let me share with you the other statement. In fact, because of the nature of the statement, I didn't know what to do with it. I don't know how many here may have known or heard let me get his full name, so. Paul C. Deisinger. Paul C. Deisinger was the administrator of Pee-wee Valley Sanitarium and School, just across the river from where I was working in Lower Indiana, near Louisville. This was a Madison unit. And I had met, when I was down in Lower Indiana in evangelism, Brother Deisinger, and he's a good man. A genuine Christian man. He'd been in mission service in Africa. I had a lot of respect for him and the Pee-wee Valley Institute as he was managing it. And I wrote to him a few years later when I was entering into this particular research in a definite way, and I asked him for information relative to R.S. Donnell, because I had heard that he had kept him and cared for him in his latter days. And this is what he wrote. I would have liked to have been present for your conversations with Elder Whelan and Wheeler from Africa. We enjoyed our work there very much, and I knew them, Whelan and Wheeler. I recall a Davis in the Memphis church, as I recall, he was not too brotherly with Elder Donnell. I didn't remember he'd written anything about Elder Donnell. He's mixing up the Davis that was in the local Memphis church where we were at that time near with a self-supporting institute near the city of Memphis, and S.S. Davis, who at this time was in Indiana. I have had different people write me regarding what we knew about Elder Donnell and the Holy Flesh idea, and I've always refused to have any part in efforts to defame the old brother, but I am sure this is not your idea. We had access to his files of correspondence and his library and often talked to him before he became fully senile. Never once did he subscribe to the doctrine of the Holy Flesh any more than that he did believe that God did expect perfection and holiness in all the people through the grace of God and the merits of the blood of Christ. He did say one time that he sort of got carried away with an idea on perfection and they were pretty hard on him. But Sister White told him, direct quotes, to be careful how they treated Elder Donnell, for he was a man of God and had a great light. Now you can see that this particular statement is absolutely opposite of the statement that came through the document file 190 from the archives of the estate. Mrs. Geisinger and I can still close our eyes and hear the dear old brother's voice as he could tell over and over again that while he had undoubtedly made some mistakes, yet Sister White said he was a man of God and had great light. I wonder if you ever heard that statement. We feel sure that Sister White did say those words, and he was surely a man of God. Even in his senility, he could kneel and offer the most wonderfully worded prayers, and I never doubted the Lord heard him. He was a great care in his later years, but we are happy to have helped this lonely old fellow. So you see there, I had problems. I had to make a judgment call. And I told you why my judgment call came down on one particular side. Now, I'm merely giving you all the full detail that you might know the rest of the story so that you can see the thing that's involved here. He admitted he made some mistakes. There's no question about it. His teaching on the incarnation was out and off base, and the text they used was also not applicable. But now, which did Sister White say? Did she say what they quoted from Indianapolis, and she was referring primarily to a discussion on the incarnation because A.T. Jones very definitely had a series of rounds back and forth with R.S. Donnell over that subject. Is that what she was referring to? Was she not referring to some of these other aspects? You see, we're facing history. And we can only evaluate history in the light of the documents and the factual material that we have. And thus I was left with a decision at that time, and I explained to you why I made it, with a judgment call on where I would come down as I wrote that particular manuscript. Now I turn to a more modern and more recent attempt to solve the problem of a sinless life in a world of sin. And the name is familiar to all of us, I'm sure, Robert D. Brinsmead. Brinsmead stated his position very carefully and very thoroughly and very completely in his first book, God's Eternal Purpose. And it was on pages 198 and 199. Let me just read you a paragraph or two what Robert Brinsmead wrote as he sought to solve the problem. He talks about the meaning of the marriage of the Lamb. He says, first, the marriage represents the work of Christ in the most holy place. Brinsmead went into the sanctuary and in the final atonement as the basis for his attempt to put forth the correct teaching on the doctrine. Those of the Holy Flesh movement did not do that. They went through the incarnation and certain aspects as far as their study was concerned. Then he says, secondly, marriage represents a work to be accomplished in the experience of God's people. Since the wise virgins go into the marriage, it is definite experience for them to participate in. The most simple, yet explanatory definition of marriage is found in these words. By the marriage is represented the union of humanity with divinity. The union of divinity with humanity took place when Christ became flesh. He united his divine nature with our fallen nature. And Brinsmead did not vary at the beginning on the doctrine of the incarnation. He was correct. It's later on that he made some changes on that. Then, speaking of Christ, he lived out a perfect sinless life in our flesh, fallen nature. Jesus did not for a moment cherish sin or have a sinful desire, propensity, or inclination. His victory over the flesh was complete and absolute. But this blessed truth must not be left there. It must be applied. Christ accomplished this in order that we, who are sinful by nature, might be partakers of the divine nature and live the same life that He lived. When our humanity is as fully united to His divinity, when our humanity is as fully united to His divinity in our life as His divinity was united in our humanity in His life, then it will be true in our experience that the flesh will be completely subjected. And in our transformed spiritual natures, we will have no inclination, propensity, desire, or relish for sin. Through Christ's ministry in the Holy of Holies, humanity is to be fully united to divinity. Hence the significance of the final atonement. This was Brinsmead's position as he set it forth. Currently, there are concepts being taught of sanctification by which we reach perfection based in a salvation by works motif. This is what we see today. And so this idea of trying to find the solution, trying to find the answer of sinlessness in a sinful nature, goes on. Beginning with the first verse. And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. In other words, there's the purpose of God and the resistance of Satan. And the Lord said unto Satan, the Lord rebuked thee, O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuked thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the burning? Or out of the fire? Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. Now notice carefully the fourth verse. And he answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with a change of raiment. God will accomplish his objective. God will realize his purpose. This is our hope. Righteousness by faith. Now, the second point that we need to realize, the suddenness of this experience. Notice the ninth verse. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes, representing the spirits of God. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. I will remove the iniquity. I will do it in one day. The suddenness of God's accomplishment is clearly set forth in this particular chapter. Not only that, this same concept is found in other places. Turn to Isaiah, the 66th chapter. Isaiah 66. And notice verses 5 to 8. Hear ye the word of the Lord, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, saith the Lord, said, let the Lord be glorified. But he shall appear to your joy, and they shall be ashamed. Let's go back over that as a point there. Hear the word of the Lord, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, said, let the Lord be glorified in our work of excommunication. But he shall appear to your joy, and they shall be ashamed. A voice of noise from the city, a voice from the temple, a voice from the Lord that rendeth recompense to his enemies. Before she travailed, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she was delivered a man-child. Who hath heard of such things? Who hath seen such things? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. The suddenness of the accomplishment. The nation that keepeth the truth, as it says here, shall a nation be born at once? Shall the earth bring forth in one day? And then if you turn to Malachi, the 3rd chapter, and verses 1 to 3, you find a further emphasis. Behold, I will send my messenger. He shall prepare the way before me, saith the Lord, whom ye seek, shall suddenly come to his temple. Even the messenger of the covenant, whom ye delight in, behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he approacheth? For he is like a refiner's fire, like a fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi, and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. He shall come suddenly to his temple. The hope will be realized suddenly, even spoken of as in one day. Now let's return for a few moments to the how. This has been the problem that's been disturbing these that have tried to find some answers. Let's turn back to Leviticus, the 16th chapter, and notice the picture there in the type in the 17th verse, Leviticus 16:17. This is a picture of the sanctuary type that we have failed to see too readily. And there shall be no man in the tabernacle of the congregation when he goeth in to make an atonement in the holy, until he come out and have made an atonement for himself and for his household and for all the congregation of Israel. I ask you again the question, how many on the day of atonement went into the holy place to accomplish that final atonement? One. Did any of the children of Israel go in? No, only the high priest went in. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. He alone went in. Now let's go a step further and notice in Leviticus the 23rd chapter, beginning with the 27th verse, the language is used there. 27 to 30. And on the 10th day of the 7th month, there shall be a day of atonement. It shall be a holy convocation unto you. And ye shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. And ye shall do no work in that same day, for it is a day of atonement to make an atonement for you before the Lord your God. For whatsoever soul it be that shall not be afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from among his people. And whatsoever soul it be that doeth any work in that same day, the same soul will I destroy from among his people. Notice there are two conditions. Soul affliction and ceasing from our work. Both of these, the first we have explored little, and the second we have emphasized the negative aspect of that much. Work. 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 Do your works. The soul that relies on his own works in that day will be what? Cut off. But also he that will not afflict his soul will be cut off. Soul affliction, what is it? This we need to explore more thoroughly and in sincerity. And I hope that this will become a primary objective with each one of us as we go through the next year. And if that be our experience, and the Lord permit us to come together again in a year, what will we see? What will we have? What will be our testimony? And we quote it avidly. Laying the glory of man in the dust and doing for him that which he cannot do for himself. There's another question there. Do we really want God to do for us what we can't do for ourselves? Do we really want God to do it? Do we really want God to put us in the dust? Do we really? It's not a matter of saying that that's what it's going to be. It's willing to have that done to us. And perhaps then we'll understand, if we're willing, soul affliction. Of supreme interest, however, is the type of persons who will constitute the 144,000. Elijah was translated without seeing death and stands as a type of that group that shall also experience the same. Let's notice just a thing or two about Elijah. We've noted before, but let's notice it again. Turn with to 1 Kings 17:1. 1 Kings 17:1. And Elijah the Tishbite, who was an inhabitant of Gilead, said unto Abraham, As the Lord God of Israel liveth, before whom I stand. Are you conscious before whom you stand? Could you say with him, I stand before God. And therefore, because I stand before him, I speak with the authority of God. There shall be no dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. And did it happen? He was so closely associated with the throne of God that he could speak, and God honored what he spoke. He was translated without seeing death. Turn again to 18:15. First Kings 18:15. And Elijah said, As the Lord of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself unto him today. That consciousness was not lost. But then he learned another thing. Turn to 1 Kings, the 19th chapter, verse 12. He became discouraged. And He went away. We talked about this the night we spoke on the loneliness of truth. And finally he found himself in a cave on Mount Sinai. The earthquake, the fire, all, God was not in any of those. And finally, after the earthquake, 12th verse, after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. Or as we noted, the literal Hebrew, a voice. A whisper, small. The voice of gentle stillness. And furthermore, we noted a quotation from the ministry of healing. When every other voice is hushed, and in the quietness we wait before Him, the silence of the soul makes more distinct the voice of God. Yes, we may thunder from Carmel. We may thunder truth. But we must come to the point that we listen to that voice of gentle stillness. And when we hear that voice, we can walk because we'll be very close to God before whom we stand. This will be the experience of the 144,000 that will be translated. Let's look at another individual, Paul. You say, why bring him in? Well, if I read Philippians 1:22-24 correctly, and I'm not going to read it, I'll let you read it. If I read those verses correctly, the Apostle Paul had a choice. Either to be translated without seeing death or to die. He chose rather to die because he loved those with whom he had labored. And he wanted to be with them to the very end. He was a chosen vessel. What kind of a vessel did Jesus choose? And remember, he had chosen the 12, he had chosen 11 of the 12. And after he went back to heaven, he made the 12th choice, the real choice, and it was Paul. But if you read the story of the book of Acts, everywhere he went, it was either a church or a riot, or both. I do not know of a single instance of a single place where he proclaimed that he had a lot of peace. You? A church or a riot or both. But in all of this, he could proclaim at the end of his missionary journeys, he stood in testimony before the governmental authorities, which he was placed. I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision. I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. Has the Lord given you a vision? I dare say that everyone that shall be translated without seeing death will have had a vision of the purpose that they are to serve in the plan of God. And they will not be disobedient to that vision. He had a special prayer request. And I dare say that that should be our prayer request. Turn to Ephesians, the 6th chapter, beginning with the 18th verse. Praying always with all prayer and supplications in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints, and for me. Don't forget to pray for me, he says. And what does he want you to pray about? Or what does he want them to pray about? That utterance may be given unto me, that I may open my mouth boldly and to make known the mystery of this of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in bonds, that therein I pray I may speak boldly as I ought to speak. He says, pray for me that I can get my mouth open first. And when I get my mouth open, that I can speak boldly that which I ought to speak, because I'm an ambassador in bond. I'm a bonded ambassador, and I need to speak boldly as I should speak the mystery of the gospel. I repeat again. Paul stands as a type of those that will be translated without seeing death. How do I know? And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. No other way. No other way than through that fountain. No other way than by that means. No other merits than those merits. But what are they to do because of those merits? And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. The word of their testimony. They could open their mouths. They could speak boldly as they ought to speak. And they loved not their lives unto death. Yes? They'll feel the death decree. They'll sense His fullness. But thank God, they will not die.